All right, folks.
I have standing next to me
a legend. Raymond R. Weil is going to talk to you about the gramophone, the third, it's a part three of the Berliner story, and it's called The Gramophone Becomes a Success. Let's check this out.
Okay. Before I begin, a few things that should be said. The first thing that should be said is, when you write history, it's the victor that writes the history. A lot of history has a lot of folk myth in it, and this is not to denigrate the Victor Talking Machine Company, but a lot of what has been written about the 1890s is myth, and in this particular period and in this particular milieu, you've all heard the idea. Somebody says something, somebody lifts it and uses it again, and the third time it's fact. This is not true with the 1890s. Now, before I begin also, there are a few things that are important to be said. When I first started this research, God back in the knows, back in the 1970s, I wrote to Oliver Berliner and asked if he knew if any family documents still existed. Oliver at that time said, check with my cousin Robert Sanders. Then maybe he may have some material for you to use. I checked with Robert Sanders. He said, yes, he indeed had some material that had belonged to his father, and invited me down to Annapolis, and would see what he had. We went down to his basement, and we unpacked this material that had been packed since his father died in the early 1960s. And he had inherited what had left of Berliner's papers. And Robert Sanders, of course, was the grandson of Emil Berliner, because his father had married Berliner's daughter. It was a fabulous trove. We even found the linen drawings of the Berliner recording machine in those particular papers. The only trouble is we didn't find enough material. I went down there again to do research and enjoyed their hospitality. And unfortunately, before this segment was written, Mr. Sanders died, and I would like to dedicate this to his memory. Also, I started writing this in 1984. Why didn't I finish it? Because the documentation is so poor for the period. I just felt that I could not do it. However, I won't give you all the ramifications. Court cases have provided some material, and thank God I was finally able to get some Xeroxes from EMI and string this material together. So here we go. After limping along since its incorporation in the latter part of 1895, the fortunes of the Berliner Gramophone Company, one other thing that I should say before we begin. There was the American Gramophone Company that was incorporated in 1891. There was the United States Gramophone Company that took over the assets, what they were, of the American Gramophone Company in 1893. It is the United States Gramophone Company that first tries to market the gramophone. They don't succeed. And so before they go under, a promoter by the name of William Jones manages to get some Philadelphia people interested in it, and they established the Berliner Gramophone Company. It has no connection with Emil Berliner, except that they marketed the gramophone, and they also made recordings and sent them to Berliner to be processed. He does not have a major interest in the company, and so once that happens, what happens with the Berliner Gramophone Company is going to affect Berliner's situation. Okay, now that we've gotten that squared away, we can go on. And by the way, if you're interested, I can give you figures of the various stock holdings, which will appear in installment four if I live long enough to write it. Okay. At last, the management could see the possible development of a practical spring motor-powered gramophone, and the disc pressings were being supplied by the Durenoid Company, which allowed a marked improvement over tone and quality. We tested Durenoid again yesterday, and after 50 times, using one needle five times, the plate was excellent. The shellac formulation used by the company was to be the first of many similar mixes used by the record industry until the early 1950s. The year 1896 also witnessed another presentation of the Berliner system before the Franklin Institute. Fred Gaisberg described it, described the things that he used, and at the end of his description he said, "Two choice morsels, twinkle, twinkle, little star, and Johnny reciting, Mary had a little lamb before company, I held in reserve." Berliner, as a result of this presentation, received the medal of the Franklin Institute. Now they debated with it what medal they should give him. They debated whether they should give him what they call the Elliott Cusson Medal or the John Scott Legacy Medal. They finally settled on the latter one, which gave him a little bit of money also. This was important because, you know, this got the recognition of the Franklin Institute. Such an award coming so soon after the new machines and the improved pressings gave additional advertising and selling points. But even more important for the future of the Berliner Gramophone Company was the enlargement of the role played by Frank Seaman, who is pictured as the heavy in the affair. He is, but he's not as heavy as we think. His New York Gramophone Company had gradually been widening its sphere and was beginning to handle national sales. If the latter statement of William Barry Owen is correct, the agreement came about in settlement of an advertising debt. The assertion bears the ring of truth, especially since there was no monetary payment and the contract was executed through Seaman purchasing or taking delivery of gramophone goods. Actually, the new contract merely confirmed the growing practice of the New York Gramophone Company, which had begun to advertise in general circulation magazines as a national gramophone company. And the earliest of that I found is in May of 1896, even though the National Gramophone Company didn't start until October. The agreement consisted of a series of resolutions. I'm not going to read all of them. I'm going to highlight a few of them because in order to understand what happens later, you have to know this contract. There was also a letter from Frederick Leonard, the company's legal advisor, saying how they should start it. Point number two, the goods shall conform to the samples heretofore submitted by the licensor to the licensee and approved by the licensee and such other samples as the licensee may hereafter approve or may himself make and give to the licensor with working drawings, patterns, cost sheets, etc., providing that the licensee shall make no sample discs or records. The licensor would, if requested, defend at its cost all actions and suits involving the validity of any other patents which may have been issued for improvements, and also for any patents that were basic. The licensee shall have the privilege of supplying by contract to the licensor gramophones and gramophone goods and parts for the repairs thereof. See, I'm cutting it considerably. The licensee had the right to organize a corporation for the carrying out of all covenants. But that corporation must be recognized by the Berliner Gramophone Company. The licensee shall use his best efforts to promote the gramophone business in the United States, and shall advertise gramophones and gramophone goods prominently and freely as Berliner Gramophones and Berliner Gramophone Goods, and shall expend immediately and at any event not later than 15 March 1897 for that purpose the sum of at least $10,000 at the lowest current publishers' prices to advertisers. The licensee was prohibited from manufacturing, buying, selling, or using gramophones or gramophone goods except those acquired from the licensor. Now, the licensee admitted the validity of the patents. The price at which the licensee received goods from the licensor would be the sum of the following three items: the actual manufacturing cost, a markup of 40% of that cost, and the royalty which the licensor was required to pay the United States Gramophone Company in the amount of 10%. That means that anything that Siemens sold would have to have a 50% markup on it. Interesting that as we go on, you'll see that Siemens is constantly trying to reduce costs, and the Berliner Gramophone Company is constantly striving to increase costs. The phrase gramophones and gramophone goods as used in this agreement shall be held to include not only the basic thing, but any improvements that are added to it, whether they are Berliner improvements or not. The Berliner Company's legal advisor also prepared instructions detailing how the contract would be initiated. Prices were now fixed for the goods to be supplied. That is $3 for each hand wind gramophone. Can't spend that for them now. And $1.50 per dozen records, with the privilege of having them re-stamped without additional payment of royalties. Siemens also approved samples of goods as provided for under Section 2, and samples of spring motor machines as per a shipment made in September. Now we're getting dates to fix your spring motors on for the spring motor interested people. The situation also was helped by the news that the basic Berliner process had finally been granted a patent. None of the equipment looked the same, but the concepts were basic to the protection of the Berliner process. This patent, in conjunction with the basic disc recording and manufacturing patent, now completed the protection process. It would now be up to the courts to decide if full patent protection would be a factor in the marketplace. And as you know, it was very much so in the 1900s. Things were not going well with the Berliner Gramophone Company, and both Frank Siemens and Emil Berliner were conscious of the company's problems. A letter that passed between the inventor and Siemens summarized the problems at the beginning of December. It was marked confidentially, but owes its survival to a court case. Mr. Peterson, one of my lawyers, and myself went very carefully over the ground and had come to the conclusion that the Berliner Gramophone Company had a chance to make a long fight relating to the cancellation of agreement. An attachment and receivership would be entirely feasible, but unless the agreement could be canceled, they would bring that, together with your contract, in as assets and prove that they were solvent. And in the meantime, because I found out that they had already come together for the purpose of raising money on stock, raise funds to pay the indebtedness. Sounds like a fairly shaky operation, doesn't it? Now, I have been most patient and enclose a copy of a letter the other day to Mr. Owen, which will show you my policy. Kindly return it. I would love to read it. The Quinn records were badly chosen by him, are mostly uninteresting, and Mr. Owen has picked slight flaws in order to put the blame on us. Conditions were unfavorable due to too great haste and lack of preparation in Philadelphia, as Gaisberg was kept busy on work for New York at the time. I went over all the arguments with Mr. Owen, pointed out to him the neglect regarding ear tubes and damper use, and do trust he will be able to modify his too emphatic judgment afterwards. I have no doubt that you catch the spirit of this letter. I have great admiration for Mr. Owen. Otherwise, but a German saying is, and I'm not going to maul German for you, or as Berliner translates it, everybody in his head has loose a screw. He who doesn't believe it has two. Nobody is as thorough, but occasionally his mind runs in ruts. I hold that Mr. Owen is in one right now. Okay. The letter indicated many of the problems that were to intensify during the next few years. Seaman was having trouble, coming up with the cash. And so he was constantly, as I had said before, trying to cut things down. Berliner was able to report to Seaman that some of that poor inspection of Philadelphia might be due to the need to produce machines in a hurry. The implication seems to be that once the bottlenecks were corrected, there would be a more dependable product. He was also able to report that the Berliner Company was beginning to make efforts to raise money to pay their indebtedness. By now, Frank Seaman had embarked on an active advertising campaign. He had already advertised in the New York Gramophone Company under the guise of the New York National Gramophone Company as early as the appearance of the Scientific American special issue on the gramophone of May of 1896. Even though the front cover had featured a prototype string wah machine, his and an ad for the Berliner Gramophone Company featured hand-propelled models. It was not until the first issue of the Phonoscope in November 15th that a spring-wound model in a round metal case was shown in an article. This is not that particular spring-wound machine. It's a similar one. In fact, you want to take this stuff and pass it around, Mike, if you would please. Or I don't think that. I'd like it back when you're finished. No, you can run it down. That way it's in sequence. Unfortunately, I had asked for an opaque projector. I didn't see one when I came in. So these are not coming in as they were supposed to. I'll explain what the pictures are later. I think you'll find them interesting. The photographic prints are through the kindness of Mr. Sanders, who went to the trouble of, I paid for it, of course, but having copy negatives made from the material. Okay. Now, it featured a hand-wound machine, but by November in the Phonoscope, you had a round metal case, such as is shown there, in their article. Now, the whole problem of this particular machine becomes critical because they need a spring-wound machine in order to have rotational stability. The old hand crank with a cord running the pressure wheel on the turntable. No one had that steady a hand to do it. All of this activity was crucial for the Berliner Gramophone Company, since it had not been able to pay off the indebtedness to the United States Gramophone Company of $75,000, and currently also owed some $15,000 to $16,000. In order to ensure the payment of the $75,000, the principal investors had arranged to pool their stock in the form of a trust. As far as I can determine, the $15,000 to $16,000 was an addition to this. Now, the trust is important to the story because the company constantly is getting involved with trusts. Now, this one in 1895, that trust runs through to 1899. And there's another one in 1899, and in part four, as I say, if I ever get around to completing it, you'll have another trust coming in, which is known as the Consolidated Talking Machine Company of America. Anyone ever hear of that name before? Anyway, even though the... All right, okay, swell. All right, there's the spring motor machine. In fact, Berliner later dated these things himself. He dated it 91. It's obviously 91. It's the Montrose machine of 96. Even though many spring motors were still presenting problems and maintain a proper rotational speed, enough progress had been made that the initial order of 200 Johnson Montrose machines was followed by one of 600 authorized by the National Gramophone Company's board on December 11, 1896. Seaman now verbally placed an oral order on March the 10th for an additional 1,000 machines, which was confirmed on March the 22nd. These presented problems for Johnson, who was now attempting to go it alone and who had agreed to pay Montrose a royalty on each machine sold. I want you to listen carefully to this particular bit of court testimony. Bookkeeper from the Berliner Gramophone Company, who worked as their bookkeeper from 1896 to 1900, described the situation. The first spring motor machine was built on a model furnished by a Mr. Montrose of Camden, New Jersey, which model Mr. Seaman adopted and placed an order for the same, which order was filled by the defendant, the Berliner Gramophone Company. The order for these motors was turned over by the said Eldridge R. Johnson, who built the machines. After the first 1,000 machines were built under the said order, a controversy arose between the said Montrose and the said Mr. Johnson, and Johnson got up a model of his own. Thereafter, said Johnson continued to build machines upon his said model, which was adopted by the complainant in giving his orders and specified as the one which was to be followed by the Berliner Gramophone Company. When Mr. Johnson began building machines, questions of patents arose as to improvements which were to be made, and an arrangement was made between Mr. Johnson and the defendant that all patents should be kept in the name of Johnson and not assigned to the defendant. The reason for this arrangement was, as was the same discussed at the time, that in the case that the Berliner Company should own the patents, the complainant would have the right to go into the open market for motors. Whereas if Johnson took out the patents in his own name, it would be impossible for the complainant to get machines except through him, Johnson, it being the policy of the company to prevent competition in manufacturing motors and other goods, and to hold the process without competition. Such policy has been carried out down to the present time, 1900, as improvements in model were made from time to time. Complainant paid the charges for changes of machinery required in the factory of said Johnson to manufacture the improved form. All models submitted to the complainant for different motors were invariably placed in the hands of Johnson for examination, and said Johnson passed on the same. Interesting, isn't it? Within a few months of the Seaman Berliner Gramophone Company agreement, a move was made to establish a scheme goods department as part of the sales picture. Scheme goods means goods that are not to be sold at retail, but are to be given away by merchants with other goods as premium to promote the sale of other goods. Such placements would greatly expand the market for the Berliner Records. They would also play a part in the Johnson and Montrose relationship in 1898. By January 7, 1897, William Newcomb was already receiving instructions and details on duties involving this department. Also by now, Berliner was ready to sell his rights in England and on the continent. Couldn't do this without thinking of Joe Pengelly. As seen in the earlier portions of this history, there had been an abortive attempt to market the gramophone and its records in Germany. Some of these had already been imported into England. Any remaining stock was basically now remainder goods. With the improvements, there was an excellent opportunity for a new trial. With regard to Europe, a substantial cash payment would be required because I would have to give out, besides the patents, the complete recipe for matrix making, matrix duplicating, etc. But I would consent to go to Europe to start them. I have also an arrangement with the Duranoid people about starting a plant there. By the middle of spring, it was definite that William Barry Owen would receive Berliner's permission to be his agent in the sale of European and English rights. In May, while in Washington, Frank Seaman met one Orville Ladau, and impressed with his credentials, decided to hire him to replace Owen after he departed from Europe. Ladau had advertising experience, and even more importantly, had worked for the Royal Baking Powder Company in the department that supplied electrotypes and mats to newspapers. That will become important in part four. Ladau almost immediately assumed his new duties. Under the arrangements, the National Gramophone Company was to ship machines and records to Owen until the English business really got a start. Almost immediately, the English and American operations began to work at cross purposes. Ladau was complaining in a letter dated July 20th, 1897. "We are 175 machines shy, and our mail is filled with urgent requests for filling of orders, now 3 weeks old. I am going to make a break towards sending you 5 machines on Saturday steamer this week, and if I fail, there will be good reason thereof." By August, it was obvious that it would take some time to dispose of the English rights. As a result, Owen resigned as a director in the National Gramophone Company and returned his one solitary share of stock to Seaman. The period following this was occupied by repeated requests for machines and records, but very little shipment. Now, Seaman kept badgering Johnson for machines and machines and machines, but without too much luck. While this was happening, a new figure comes onto the scene. Emil Berliner, at one time, employed Joseph W. Jones, who was the son of William C. Jones, the promoter of the Berliner Gramophone Company. While working in the laboratory, he became familiar with the majority of the Berliner processes and some of Berliner's experiments and theories. Joe Jones was allowed to drift away despite Berliner's misgivings, and with backing from one G. Vincent, began to develop a rival system. Berliner stated, "I saw Joe J.'s machine. I always advocated that he should remain and be retained in the folds of our interests and not be permitted to drift into an opposition concern. I suggested to Mr. Parvin long ago that all three companies should together support a laboratory for mechanical experiments in Philadelphia, and for such a one, Joe J. would be good to put in charge. Wouldn't cost very much and would pay all of us. As for the machines, they were not absolutely flawless when they arrived here, but they have some excellent points, and there should be money in them," etc., etc., etc. In 98, these machines will surface as the Wonder Double Bell talking machines. On an earlier occasion, the probability is that Jones and Vincent, with their new machines, infringe on my 95 patent. Also, they are planning to market this machine in Europe, which is not boding well for Owen. The Berliner Gramophone Company relied upon facilities maintained by Berliner in Washington for the processing of all zinc matrices. While offices were maintained next to the Grand Army of the Republic Hall at 1410 Pennsylvania Avenue, the laboratory and processing facility was maintained in the large powerhouse building of the Washington and Georgetown Company's cable powerhouse. We have some pictures of it here. And that's that one. This shows how the location is right near 1410. And the facility housed not only the Berliner operations, but laboratories of Charles Sumner Tainter of King Fabrizio fame, and facilities of Maurice Joyce, an electrotyper who was occasionally relied upon by Berliner in helping make matrices. This is a tremendous building. It occupied one entire city block. However, on the night of September 29th, one of the sections of the building caught fire, and the entire building was completely destroyed. There's a picture of the which we have of the ruins of the thing, and they really did a job on it. So you cannot expect new records in a hurry. 100 matrices, 40 almost finished, are in the ruins. We expect to get another place tomorrow and resume in about 2 weeks. Seaman also wrote to Owen saying that the laboratory was burned out a few days ago, and Mr. Childs, any of you ever heard of Calvin G. Childs?
Yes.
He's working for them. He's going to have to work nights with Sousa's band, etc., to replace the 100-odd records which were destroyed. They should have been sent to the Duranite Company days before the fire occurred, but Mr. Berliner took Darby off his work to fix up his sound box. Berliner was trying to make a sound box in competition with the one Johnson was providing on machines. There are some pictures taken inside of the laboratory in this group, and that particular one shows the one at the left of the with the etching pass shows Sanders. What? One at the left is Mr. Sanders, and the one at the right behind the lathe is Sinclair Darby. Okay, now, soon after the signing of the contract with the Berliner Company, William Barry and the two incorporators, they ratified an agreement with Seaman to supply records and machines. Although shipments were directed to the National Gramophone Company and some checks were directly drawn by them, the Berliner Gramophone Company refused to recognize National and held Seaman to his personal license, somewhat similar to the earlier situation between Jesse Lippincott and the North American Phonograph Company. At the meeting of October 1st, 1897, Frank Seaman resigned as president and was to be succeeded by Oliver Liddell. Contracts were to be reassigned and a new contract entered into with Frank Seaman to sell and deliver to this company any and all gramophone goods which it may require, so far as it shall be possible for him to obtain same under and by virtue of his said contract, and with a slight markup and with for advertising. The scene was now set for changes. You have the National Gramophone Company, which is not responsible really to anyone. They're just receiving goods from Seaman. And so the first indication of changes was the appearance of an ad in the New York paper, The Sun, Sunday, December the 19th, 1897. The Vocophone, the improved gramophone, is the most of a Christmas present to be found in two hemispheres, from $5 to $25, and it will be as much enjoyed on the 4th of July. Call and hear it. National Gramophone Company, 874 Broadway, corner of 18th Street. According to Thomas Parvin, the Berlin Gramophone Company demanded of Seaman an explanation of this advertisement. No satisfactory explanation was ever given. How could he explain it? He didn't put the ad in. The National Gramophone Company put the ad in. Anyway, there is much more to the story. As I say, this thing got away from me as I was writing it. And so what you will have to do is wait until the rest of this exciting installment appears, hopefully, in the Ars Journal somewhere down the line in about 2 years. I hope it explains a little bit for you.